From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Pistorius is sentenced to prison for killing his girlfriend.
Hopefully, this judgment on sentence shall provide some sort of closure for the family and for all concerned.
Kurds and Islamic State militants continue fighting for Kobani. Thousands of home medical kits are distributed in an Ebola-hit Liberian capital. And we visit a church without a God. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. A South African judge has sentenced superstar athlete Oscar Pistorius for killing his girlfriend last year at his Pretoria home. VOA's Anita Powell was in the Pretoria courtroom for the much-awaited sentence that brought an end to the nearly year-long trial.
Oscar Pistorius could spend as much as 5 years or as little as 10 months in prison for killing his girlfriend Reba Steenkamp, a sentence that is dividing opinion in a nation that has been riveted by his trial. Judge Thokozile Masipa took more than an hour to explain her sentence. She convicted Pistorius in September for culpable homicide, roughly equivalent to the American charge of manslaughter.
Hopefully, this judgment on sentence shall provide some sort of closure for the family and for all concerned so that they can move on with their lives. There's a delicate balance between the crime, the criminal, and the interests of society. The extent of the negligence in culpable homicide cases plays an important role in coming to an appropriate sentence, which should neither be too severe nor too light.
The athlete, who won international glory for being the first double amputee to compete in the Olympics, was immediately whisked to a holding area after sentencing Tuesday. Pistorius claims he mistook Reba Steenkamp, his girlfriend of 3 months, for a nighttime intruder, and shot her dead through a locked bathroom door because he feared for his life. Under South African law, he must serve at least 1/6 of his sentence, about 10 months, before he can be considered for parole. The 5-year sentence is half the prison time prosecutor Harry Nell asked for. National Prosecuting Authority spokesman Nati Mube would not say whether the state will appeal. Pistorius could have faced up to 15 years imprisonment for culpable homicide.
As we have already stated before, that we were disappointed with the conviction on culpable homicide. We still maintain the same position. You know, we've noted also the sentence that was delivered today. We have not made up our minds whether we're going to appeal it or not. We are going to obviously to go and consider, because it is not a very straightforward matter. There's law that needs to be considered. There is an appetite, obviously, to appeal, but as I said, we have 14 days to consider.
Reba Steenkamp's mother, June, left the court indicating to local reporters she thought justice had been served. The Women's League of the ruling African National Congress, which has been a constant presence alongside Steenkamp's family in court, said in a statement that they are dissatisfied with the result. The group has protested since the beginning of Pistorius's case and claims Steenkamp's death is yet another case of South Africa's epidemic of domestic abuse. But such claims were never proven in court. Women's League spokeswoman Jackie Mofokeng said the group is seeking an appeal.
We're not happy with the verdict and we're not happy with the sentence, because this is sending a very, very wrong message out there. We have people with disability and they've been sentenced before and it cannot change anything. We are not happy with even culpable homicide. That's what we wanted. And when we go for an appeal, we are calling that he gets sentenced to murder. The charge should be murder and nothing else.
The trial has riveted South Africa and is the first major criminal trial in the country to be broadcast live. Judge Masipa acknowledged that the case is unusual and has been affected by Pistorius' international fame, but said that did not affect her judgment. I might add, she said, that it would be a sad day for this country if there was one law for the poor and disadvantaged and another for the rich and famous. The trial has underscored fundamental inequalities in this still-divided nation, where rampant corruption at the highest level has demonstrated that there is a wide gap between the haves and the have-nots. That was illustrated when it was revealed the Steenkamp family has been taking secret monthly payments from Pistorius following their daughter's death. But with Pistorius now behind bars, many South Africans are asking themselves, was justice done? Anita Powell, VOA News, Pretoria, South Africa.
Doctors Without Borders, also known by its French acronym MSF, distributed thousands of home medical kits on Monday in the Liberian capital, Monrovia, which has been particularly hard hit by the Ebola outbreak. Marcello Mazzotti is a MSF distribution manager in Monrovia.
We know that it's not easy to do a fair distribution, you know, when you just drop the kits or the buckets to the community leaders or chairmen for them to then take responsibility to distribute them in the community. So that's why we prefer to do it ourselves in order to reach really everybody.
In Liberia, where Ebola patients have been turned away from overflowing clinics, the kits have products to look after ill family members. As families care for the sick, potentially exposing themselves to Ebola, the humanitarian teams on the ground hope that the spread of the disease will be slowed by the materials they distribute. Sheldon Yet is country representative for United Nations Children's Fund, or UNICEF.
These kits are designed to do just that, to break the cycle of transmission. They're not designed to be a substitute for hospital care. They're not designed to be a substitute for any kind of care that can be provided in a professional health clinic or medical establishment. They're designed to ensure that a family member can provide basic assistance in the interim period before somebody can go to an Ebola treatment unit.
Meanwhile, the mayor of Freetown pleaded with merchants, bikers, security officers, and Ministry of Health officials to keep the capital's citizens off the streets, to reduce crowds, especially in markets, to improve Ebola prevention efforts. The World Health Organization says the city remains a hotbed of transmission. The WHO says Nigeria is free from Ebola after 42 days passed with no new reported cases. WHO representative Rui Gama spoke Monday in Lagos.
This is a spectacular success story that shows to the world that Ebola can be contained. But we must be clear that we only won a battle. The war will only end when West Africa is also declared free of Ebola.
Nigerian President Goodluck Jonathan issued a statement Monday praising Nigerians who worked to contain the disease. He also directed that all anti-Ebola measures in Nigeria remain in effect, including health screenings for people entering the country. Nigeria had 20 cases of Ebola and 8 deaths as part of the worst ever outbreak of Ebola. Alessandro Fesbignani is a professor at Northeastern University's College of Computer and Informational Sciences. He has developed a computer model that he says can predict the spread of Ebola through airplane routes. VOA's Ira Melman asked him how and why he did this.
How? It's through numerical computational model. That means that basically we recreate a synthetic world in the computer that integrates data on the human population, where we are and how we move, including international airline transportation. And the why, it's clear. We won't try to project the probability, the likelihood to get cases of Ebola imported from West Africa and other places of the world. Also to get what is the number of cases that we can expect and how is the evolution of the epidemic worldwide.
And your findings say what as far as the spread, when and to what areas of the world?
Well, what happened is that in West Africa, the epidemic is still increasing consistently in the sense that we have an increasing number of cases in the region. And obviously, the probability that some of those cases, when still in the incubation phase, are traveling to other countries is increasing. That means that we see probabilities for several European countries as well as for several African countries that are getting larger and larger of receiving one or two of those infected people in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
Now, this is based totally on transportation data, is that correct?
Well, on transportation data and epidemiological data, because also we need to have a quite accurate description of the disease dynamic in West Africa, as well as eventually in other countries.
The spread of the disease has something to do with most of the air travel and where passengers traveling from Africa will use as a transfer point. Is that correct?
Yeah, for the international spread, the most important component, obviously, is the airline transportation. That is the way people travel from West Africa to U.S. or Europe or China or India. And what we have, indeed, in the model is a very accurate description of the transportation and also really actually the flows of people, basically the origin and destination of people from West Africa to other countries.
And where are those points?
Well, you know, the countries that at the moment obviously see risk of importation are countries that are in Africa, like Ghana, Senegal, where we already had one case, Mali, Gambia, Morocco, South Africa, Kenya. United States have had already one case, and they might possibly get one or two more, but, you know, France as well, United Kingdom, Belgium are countries that have an appreciable risk. When I talk about risk, I talk about a probability between, 10 to 20% of having an imported cases in the next 4 to 6 weeks.
When I hear you talking about this in transportation, you obviously know that here in this country, there are many politicians and so far a majority of the people, according to some polls, that say a transportation ban from West Africa is what is needed. Do you agree with that?
Well, let me say, first of all, that already at the very moment we are speaking, there is about 60 to 80% traffic reduction to and from the region. That's just because of, all the travel warnings and advisory that obviously people do not travel there. And also several airlines company have already discontinued flight to the region, et cetera. So we are already in a situation in which there is a consistent and noticeable decrease of traffic to and from the region. Travel bans might push these a little bit further. However, you know, this kind of travel restrictions tends just to delay the importation of cases. In a sense, you know, an 80% travel reduction just consists in a 4 weeks delay. If you do a 95% travel reduction, that would consist in a severe screening and travel bans, etc., we would probably get 4 more weeks or so. So you see, there is we don't buy too much time with this strategy, although it might be, you know, beneficial in some cases. There are several things to consider. First of all, it is a strategy that must be coordinated worldwide. It's, unilateral travel bans are not very effective because the people could travel, you know, to another country and then from that country to another place. That must also, you know, consider that, people might be induced to travel in a way that, you know, hiding the place where they are coming from. And so that would complicate the tracking of people if they get sick. In addition, there are economical costs to that. And so, you know, it's a very complicated decision that obviously depends on many, many facets.
Alessandro Visbignani is a professor at Northeastern University's College of Computer and Informational Sciences.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's voanews.com. Online news for a changing world.
Kurdish fighters and Islamic State militants continue to battle in the northern Syrian town of Kobani. Plumes of smoke could be seen today from across the border in Turkey as the two sides clashed again in the weeks-long fight that has drawn international support to help the Kurds hold off militant attempts to take the town. The Britain-based Syrian Observatory for Human Rights said planes from the U.S.-led coalition also carried out fresh airstrikes in the area today, targeting the Islamic State group. VOA correspondent Scott Bobb is along the Turkey-Syria border outside Kobani.
There are plumes of smoke late this morning and at midday, we heard from refugees from Kobani who were speaking to their people inside the city that there were two airstrikes from the coalition. There has also been exchanges of fire between the Kurdish militias and the Islamic State militants. There still is shelling around the border crossing, which appears to be an important target for the Islamic State fighters. And the West, which is under control of the Kurdish militias, has been quieter today than it was in previous days.
Turkey says it is helping Iraqi Kurds cross into Syria to aid Kurdish fighters as they fight the Islamic State militants. The announcement came Monday by the Turkish foreign minister. What is the reaction there to this announcement?
I spoke with a local official of the Kurdish group there, the YPD, from Kobani, who had crossed over last night, and his reaction was, it's good news if it happens. They're a bit suspicious it will, in fact, occur. Often they say the Turkish government says things, but they do not actually happen on the ground. If it does happen, then it's good news, but they are adopting a sort of a wait-and-see attitude, at least at the official level.
Perhaps you'll explain to us why the Turkey government is hesitant.
Well, it's a very complicated situation. First of all, as a country bordering all this violence and conflict for more than 3 years, Turkey has had terrorist attacks on its own soil from various groups who are not happy with Turkey's policies. So there's a caution by all of the Syrian neighbors as to not to take too strong a side, if possible, and risk themselves being dragged into the conflict. Turkey has had a long-standing battle with its own Kurdish militants who want autonomy at the very least and some want independence from Turkey in their parts of Turkey. And the YPD, which is the Syrian sort of equivalent organization in Syria, has often allied and sent fighters to help the Kurdish group in Turkey called the PKK. So there's a great deal of suspicion of allowing and cooperating too much with the YPD in Syria. Other than that, Turkey's great enemy at the moment appears to be the government of Syrian President Bashar al-Assad, and they would like to see that be the focus of the fighting and the efforts in Syria. So it's a very complicated situation, and what you hear is not always what is actually going on the ground.
What are the conditions like there today for the refugees?
Well, the refugees, the ones I've spoken to, they're getting food and they get some medicine and some clothing and blankets, but they say that's not enough, and they're living in plastic sheeting type tents, and the nights are getting very cold here. It's at an altitude on the high plains. The wind can be very bitter. The children are beginning to fall sick, and the elderly as well. And so there's a great deal of worry. They're grateful for the help they're getting, and will say so very quickly, but they also are very worried about the future with winter coming on.
And any response to those U.S. drops we had earlier this week of weapons, ammunition, and medical supplies?
Yes, from Kobani, we heard from various doctors that medicines had been received. They said they did not know where they came from, but that they had received them and were distributing them. From this side, the Turkish side, there's a great deal of satisfaction that someone from the outside had stepped up and made a statement or helped them. And so at the moment, the U.S. government and its coalition partners are very popular among these people. Of course, they quickly say it's not enough. They say they need heavy weapons and ammunition to counter the much better armed Islamic State militants, they say. And until they get that, it's going to be very hard to win Kobani back. Nevertheless, their forces are resisting, and so far, Kobani has not been overrun, as was feared just a few weeks ago.
VOA correspondent Scott Bobb along the Turkey-Syria border outside Kobani. Thousands of pro-democracy protesters gathered in the streets of Hong Kong today to watch the meeting between government officials and pro-democracy activists that was broadcast live on television. They jeered and booed when government officials like Hong Kong Chief Secretary Carrie Lam spoke. Many like Venus Wong say they have heard the government's arguments before, that achieving truly free elections without China's first approving candidates for office will take time and patience and must be conducted in a lawful manner. However, the protesters cheered when it was their sides to speak. Jasper Tam said the activists passionately articulated their key demand for the right to vote and their resolve to continue their struggle for democracy. The debate changed few minds and offered no compromises the protesters were inclined to accept. But Nikki Lau says the fact that both sides engaged in dialogue was progress. RAND Corporation China analyst Scott Harold said it is positive the two sides finally agreed to meet after earlier talks this month were canceled.
It shows on some level that the government of Hong Kong has to take seriously and be responsive to the perspectives of people who have been willing to mobilize for 3+ weeks now. So I think there's a positive there. I think there's a possibility that the government in Hong Kong may be nearing a point where it has to offer up some suggestions of where it would be willing to budge.
There is no definite word yet on a second round of talks. Atheists, by definition, do not believe in God, so they should have no need for a church. But 2 years ago, a pair of British stand-up comedians decided to create one. Sanderson Jones and Pippa Evans told the BBC they envisioned something like church, but without God. Their Sunday Assembly movement has grown from a single congregation in London to dozens of churches around the world. Reporter Mike Osborne visited with the members of a Sunday Assembly that now meets regularly in the U.S. city of Nashville, Tennessee.
Sunday morning, time for the monthly atheist assembly in a downtown Nashville park.
Stand out with me, guys!
The gathering really does look and feel very much like church. There are songs, all Beatles tunes on this day.
The comfort and care on which we depend is given.
Special readings, a message, even an offering at the end of the service. Original Nashville Assembly member Landry Butler says church provides a great model for building a sense of community.
That has a powerful way of bringing people together for the common good and of focusing that energy. And so we wanted to use that as a model because it's something that people are familiar with.
Church is especially familiar in this region. Religious participation rates in Tennessee are some of the highest in the nation. So Butler says he's always surprised at how many believers show up for the assembly.
They go back to their regular church the other Sundays of the month, and then they come and hang with us when they can. And that's been a good way of sort of bridging those two communities.
That gap between believers and atheists has always been tense and sometimes hostile. Butler says the assembly isn't interested in conflict.
There are a lot of atheists out there who like to beat up on religious people, and we're not about that. We want to be all-inclusive.
A good example of that inclusiveness plays out regularly at a local homeless shelter. Volunteers from the Sunday Assembly routinely help serve meals at Room in the Inn, a Christian ministry that serves Nashville's homeless. The group prepares food, serves it, and interacts with the men and women who show up for a hot meal. Elvis Wilson says one of the Sunday Assembly's core values is help often.
As an atheist, you know, I want everybody to know that I care, and I, you know, we have moral values. We want to live in the now. We want to make sure people in this lifetime are treated with respect and well taken care of.
The Sunday Assembly movement has experienced phenomenal growth. At the end of September, more than 30 new assemblies met on a single Sunday. The founders, British comedians Sanderson Jones and Pippa Evans, are now in the process of crowdfunding a website that they hope will tie the global movement together. For VOA News, I'm Mike Osborne in Nashville, Tennessee.
Iconic designer Oscar de la Renta has died, leaving behind a legendary career as one of the most recognized names in fashion. He was 82 years old. Spanish-language television network Univision reported that De La Renta died after a 10-year battle with cancer. The designer, who was born in the Dominican Republic, rose to international prominence in the 1960s, dressing First Lady Jacqueline Kennedy. In a decade since, his fashion house was best known for voluptuous gowns. In a 2013 interview, De La Renta said, "Style is a discipline." The designer added, "If you don't dress well every day, you lose the habit. It's not about what you wear, but about how you live your life." Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.